I've been having a lot of apocalyptic type dreams lately. And that's highly unusual for me. I almost never have recurring dreams. But it got me thinking, what if we already survived the apocalypse? Though not the exciting kind. You know, the kind with massive explosions, zombies, or the sudden need to learn how to farm potatoes or something. Instead, the slow, dull implosion of everything we were told mattered. The kind of collapse that comes with notifications. The quiet type of apocalypse. The one where your student loans outlive your democracy. And you didn't even notice it happening. Nobody really did. Well, maybe there were some uncomfortable signs that you chose to ignore. And, well, let's admit it, it's difficult to spot the end of the world when you're still waiting on an Amazon delivery. The banks didn't fail overnight or collapse spectacularly like they did at the end of Fight Club. They just started charging you monthly fees to remind you that they exist and that they still hold sway over your life. The federal government didn't disintegrate suddenly. It instead slowly, insidiously inflated and devalued our currency supply while wages stagnated. And the politicians didn't fall. They just turned into influencers and bad actors with worse lighting. And, well, the churches didn't dissolve. They just transformed into something like wellness retreats with a 10% discount code for CBD candles. So it's not really a disaster movie. It's more like an email thread. And yet somehow, this is what we survived into. The aftermath. The leftovers. The long, weird hangover after a 400-year bender called progress. It's kind of funny. Every generation thinks they're living at the end of the world, but ours might actually be legit. And not because of asteroids or nuclear war, but because meaning itself seems to have just packed up and left. Albert Camus said the only serious philosophical question is whether to kill yourself. But honestly, Camus never had to deal with a soul-crushing 9-to-5, insurmountable debt, dopamine addiction, techno-feudalism, and the threat of artificial intelligence rendering you obsolete. You know, we were told the system worked, and that if we studied hard and followed the rules and believed in the so-called dream, we'd get the good life. But the dream turned out to be a pyramid scheme with a public relations department. And yeah, I think it bears repeating. George Carlin warned us. It's called the American Dream because you have to be asleep to believe it. And we were. But now, everyone's half awake, staring around at the smoldering ruins and thinking, so what now? And that's the thing about collapse. It doesn't really look like the movies. It looks like a gradual disillusionment. Kind of like watching a relationship slowly die. Not with one big fight, but with a long, corrosively awkward silence. The economy's a joke. The political system's a drunken open mic night. The education system's a debt trap disguised as self-improvement. And mental health, well, let's just say the most honest psychiatrist these days is a bottle of whiskey and a Spotify playlist called Melancholy for the Working Class. But here's the weird part. The hopeful part, if you can call it that. I think there's a strange kind of freedom, like a liberation of sorts, in watching everything fall apart. Because once the old myths die, you're no longer obligated to believe in them. And there's this odd sense of relief because you don't have to prop up this shit show anymore. And that's what this video is really about. It's not the collapse so much, but what comes after. After the American dream dies and the once omnipotent institutions fall. And after we finally stop pretending that everything's fine. So maybe it's worth considering that the aftermath isn't the end at all. Maybe it's the first honest moment we've had in centuries. And that's exciting, but it's also terrifying. All right. So the first casualty of collapse, it isn't the infrastructure. It's belief. Bridges will stand long after people stop trusting the map. And for the last few decades, we've been driving in circles pretending we still know what the hell we're doing or where we're going. The USA, you know, it wasn't just a country, it was a story. A glossy, a high budget myth about freedom. Opportunity and hard work paying off. Like a corporate-sponsored fairy tale or something. Now, the only problem is that somewhere around the mid-2000s, we all realized the story had no ending. It just looped. You work, you buy, you scroll, you die. Isn't that catchy? And the end credits never roll. Because the subscription just auto-renews. So, the American dream was our national religion. And now we're standing in this empty, deteriorating cathedral, burned out, bankrupt, holding the receipt for a life that never got delivered. Joseph Campbell wrote that myths give life meaning. They tell you who you are and why you suffer, and they also tell you what's worth worshiping. Now, our myth was very simple. If you obeyed the rules, you'd be rewarded. But that stopped being true somewhere between Enron, the Iraq War, and your rent doubling for an apartment with black mold and character. Ernest Becker once said, "We invent myths to distract ourselves from the knowledge that we're going to die." Which makes sense. I mean, it's hard to face your own mortality when you're also trying to hit your quarterly targets or whatever. So we built an economy around denial. Denial became a lifestyle brand. I mean, we didn't want to be mortal. We wanted to be successful. And the dream was so convincing that even now, as the system coughs up blood, people still defend it. They still post motivational quotes about grind culture while working three jobs and crying into a McDonald's napkin. That's the beauty of a dying myth. It doesn't stop working when it fails. It stops working when people admit it failed. Until then, it limps along, zombie-like, fueled by hashtags, caffeine, and delusion. Or Christopher Lash called this the culture of narcissism. It's a society so obsessed with performance that the mask became the face. We turned self-reliance into isolation. We turned individualism into loneliness. We transformed ambition into constant anxiety. And then we sold each other the self-help books to make it all feel meaningful again. You can almost hear the ghost of George Carlin sighing. And now that everyone's half awake, we're realizing something terrifying. There's no new dream to replace the dying American dream. There's no unifying story. Just 1,000 little algorithmic cults all screaming into the void. So you've got the tech optimists promising salvation through data, the entrepreneurs preaching hustle as a holy scripture. We've got the wellness influencers selling inner peace through kale smoothies and woo-woo capitalism. And the rest of us, the ones who still vaguely remember sincerity, we're sitting here like, so are we supposed to pretend any of this actually means something? I mean, it's funny, or tragic, or both, I guess, that a civilization can survive plagues, wars, recessions, but not the moment it stops believing in its own bullshit. Because that's when the real collapse begins. Not when the economy tanks, but when irony becomes the only language anyone actually trusts anymore. And we've reached that point now. Let's call it the era of smirking disbelief. It's where everyone knows the system is broken, but no one is willing to stop the performance. Because the performance is the system. And if you're wondering how that happened, well, it's because the myth didn't die of natural causes. We murdered it with cynicism, endless distraction, and an epidemic of subscription services. But maybe that's okay. You know, maybe myths have to die so we can finally stop mistaking them for reality. Maybe the point of collapse isn't to destroy the story, but to clear space for more, well, a more true story to grow. All right. So the strange thing about living through the end of an empire is that you can't really tell when it's over. There's no final trumpet blast or slow motion montage of flags falling. Just more commercials. Okay, I mean, collapse doesn't announce itself. It markets itself. Rome had its bread and circuses, and we've got Wi-Fi and streaming subscriptions. Different tools, but same distraction. You know, at least the Romans had lions. We get algorithmic recommendations for content that feels emotionally similar to despair. Now, we used to have reality, and then we outsourced it to screens. Now everything is theater, politics, morality, even grief. We've basically turned existence into a brand campaign. The Republic didn't fall. It just got a new logo and a TikTok strategy. So Guy Debord called this the society of the spectacle, and he wrote about this back in the 1960s. And this is where image replaces truth and the performance becomes more real than the thing it's imitating. So we used to experience the world, but now we just experience our reaction to it. We don't really live, we comment on living. Elections feel like product launches. Tragedies get edited into short-form empathy clips. Protests have sponsorship deals. And somewhere along the way, rebellion became an aesthetic. Rage turned into merch. Every evolutionary or revolutionary impulse ends up printed on a tote bag made in the same factory as the system it's rebelling against. And yeah, it's pretty absurd. But it's also rather genius. Because what better way to neutralize dissent than to make it fashionable? If your rebellion can be monetized, it can be controlled. And if it can be controlled, well, it's not rebellion. It's marketing. Neil Postman warned us that we wouldn't be destroyed by tyranny, but by trivia. That we'd amuse ourselves to death. And he was right. The new totalitarianism doesn't burn books. It drowns them in endless scrollable content until you forget books even existed. And the real slap in the face here is we're complicit. We feed the beast with every click and like and every desperate attempt to prove that we're still relevant in a world that's forgotten how to be real. Because reality now runs on engagement metrics. Meaning is just a setting in the algorithm. So, one of the fundamental themes running through Philip K. Dick's novels is the question asking, what defines reality? And in a nutshell, his answer, that which, when you stop believing it, in it, doesn't go away. Well, we've stopped believing in just about everything, and nothing's gone away. We're stuck in a collective hallucination where everyone's pretending not to notice that the walls are melting. We scroll through chaos like tourists in our own extinction. Doom scrolling is performance art. Every catastrophe becomes just another piece of entertainment between cat videos and the skin care ads. And you can tell people are exhausted because irony has replaced emotion at this point. Sincerity is now treated like a red flag, a sign that you haven't adapted to the apocalypse properly. If you actually care about something, people look at you like you've just admitted you believe in magic or the Easter Bunny. And, well, maybe you do, because in a world this fake, caring about anything feels a little mystical. This is a society that confuses awareness with action and outrage with virtue. It's a world that confuses branding with identity. Everyone's selling something, even the nihilists. Half of them have Patreon pages, and the other half are writing think pieces about why hope is a fascist construct. But underneath all this irony, the memes and, you know, the performative despair, there's this quiet collective hunger for something real. For connection that isn't mediated by bandwidth. For truth that doesn't come prepackaged in aesthetic fonts. And, well, for a story that doesn't feel like an ad. And maybe that's the point of all this make-believe. To exhaust us of our illusions until we're just too tired to lie anymore. And maybe when the spectacle finally collapses under the weight of its own absurdity, we'll remember that the stage was built on dirt, sweat, blood, and real human faces. So, civilizations don't die like people. They decompose like ecosystems. So the end isn't a bang. It's a slow rot. And honestly, I find that kind of comforting. Because at least rot feeds or fertilizes something. What we're living through now isn't really the apocalypse. It's composting. We're watching the old world break down into the raw material for whatever the hell comes next. And yeah, it smells terrible. I mean, DK usually does. But here's something to consider. Maybe this is how cultures regenerate. They collapse under their own bullshit, fertilize the soil, and hope that the next generation or the next version grows fewer sociopaths and narcissists. John Michael Greer calls this catabolic collapse, which is a process where societies digest themselves to survive. They stop expanding and start cannibalizing their own myths. And eventually, they slim down enough to function again. It's kind of like watching an empire go on a spiritual cleanse. Painful and messy, but nonetheless weirdly necessary. And this could be where we are now. The detox stage of history. The fever breaking. Like a collective hangover after centuries of chasing infinite growth on a finite planet. And for years, we've been told to be optimistic, to trust the system, and, you know, to believe in progress. But maybe collapse is progress. Maybe we needed the old world to fail so we could stop confusing comfort with meaning. Carl Jung said that no tree can grow to heaven unless its roots reach down to hell. Well, there we are. Waist deep in the underworld, surrounded by the compost of our own hubris. And for the first time in a long time, something honest is growing. And look around. People are leaving the corporate cults. They're starting gardens, small communities, smaller independent businesses, cottage industry, off-grid lives, or at least group chats where they can be honest for once. And, art's getting weird again, which is always a good sign in my book. You know, you can always tell when a civilization is getting real because its art stops trying to impress and starts trying to feel. Rebecca Solnit wrote that in disasters, people often behave better than usual. They're actually more cooperative and compassionate and more human. So maybe collapse strips away the bullshit and reminds us who we actually are beneath the roles and the LinkedIn titles. You know, when the lights go out, suddenly you remember your neighbors exist. And when systems fail and money stops making sense, people rediscover competence. And meaning starts to actually matter again. Now, sure, not everyone makes it. Some people are going to cling to the wreckage and call it salvation. Others are going to build shrines to the old gods of productivity and success, like tech bros preaching transcendence while crying into their crypto portfolios. But there's another group, the quiet ones, the patient ones, the slightly disillusioned but still breathing ones, who know that every empire is just compost waiting to happen. And maybe they're already out there building the next version of civilization. Only simpler and more honest. Not skyscrapers, communities. Not innovation, repair. Not utopia, functionality. Because maybe that's the real evolution here. Less ambition, more authenticity. Less progress and more presence. Ivan Illich, the author, not the book by Tolstoy, once said that the more we institutionalize human needs, the less human we become. So collapse is just that idea hitting its natural conclusion. Because we outsourced meaning and connection and wisdom to systems that couldn't sustain them. And now, nature, being a patient editor, is deleting our mistakes. It's humbling. And it's terrifying. But it's also kind of beautiful. Because for all our noise and narcissism, there's something, I think, deeply poetic about a species that has to fall apart to remember how to live. I mean, we've spent centuries trying to conquer nature, only to find out that the real battle was with our own delusion of control. And when that delusion finally cracks, when the buildings crumble and the markets collapse and the when the Wi-Fi dies finally, what's left might not actually be despair. It might actually be a sense of relief. You know what's funny? For all our obsession with community, most of us haven't actually had one since MySpace was relevant. We've got followers, subscribers, contacts, matches, networks, but almost nobody to help us move some furniture. Maybe that's why the old world had to collapse. So we'd finally get tired of pretending that connection through pixels was somehow enough. Now, Ivan Illich once wrote that the more a society replaces personal relationships with professional ones, the more it loses its soul. And that's exactly what we've done. We've outsourced empathy to apps. And we let corporations mediate our friendships and our feelings. And then we let algorithms decide what we care about. And the result was loneliness so dense you could sell it by the ounce. But here is the odd little silver lining. When the institutions fall apart and the big systems stop pretending to care, it's amazing how fast people start to actually care again. And you see it after every disaster. When the power goes out, people check on their neighbors and share generators. When society stops functioning, humanity starts showing up for the most part. That's the secret nobody really tells you about collapse. It's not always the end of community. It's just the beginning of real ones. So the new tribe doesn't look like a utopian commune or some Instagram-ready version of self-sufficiency. It's quieter and more practical, though definitely a little rougher. It's people realizing they just can't go it alone anymore. And that hyper-independence was just capitalism's loneliest marketing stunt. You see it in small things. Neighbors pooling groceries, artists trading work instead of money, friends turning abandoned lots into gardens, the rebirth of borrowed sugar in a world that forgot sharing was even a thing. And it's not some insufferable hippie fantasy, it's survival. Humans are pack animals. And for centuries, we pretended that being isolated was the same as being free. It wasn't. It was just another kind of prison. One with Wi-Fi and DoorDash. Wendell Berry said, "The smallest unit of health is the community." And he's right. Because once the grand narrative dies, the American dream, the nation, the empire, the only story left is the one that we tell each other. Face to face, voice to voice. No likes or followers, no analytics, just honesty and whatever passes for coffee in the ruins. This is where meaning sneaks back in. Though not in grand solutions or revolutions, but in small acts of decency. The tribe doesn't fix the world, it remakes it. One meal, one favor, one broken thing repaired instead of replaced. Then yeah, it's messy. People will still fight. Some will hoard. Some will try to turn it into a brand. Collapse Core. Authentic rural living for $19.99 a month. But eventually, I believe reality wins. Because the one thing collapse always seems to do is kill the illusion of separation. You start to realize we're all just slightly confused apes trying to keep each other alive long enough to laugh about it. And that's when the new story starts to write itself. Not how can I get ahead, but how can I help us not fall apart again? And in a weird way, it feels somehow better, simpler. There's a kind of peace in accepting that no one's coming to save you, but everyone around you might. So Viktor Frankl wrote that meaning isn't something you find, it's something you create through responsibility. And maybe that's the quiet revolution waiting inside this whole mess. We stop outsourcing purpose to institutions and start earning it the old-fashioned way, through each other. So maybe the future doesn't belong to the billionaires or the politicians or, the AI profits. Maybe it belongs to the stubborn, kind, slightly broken people who kept showing up when everything else stopped working. That's the tribe. It's not a movement or a brand. It's just a few decent people trying to live sanely in a world that forgot how. Okay. So you can always tell a dying civilization by its stories. Rome had the gladiators. Well, we have influencers. Both were willing to bleed for attention, though at least the Romans had better outfits. Every empire runs on myth. Some collective hallucination that makes the suffering seem noble. And for a while, ours was the so-called American dream. Work hard, play by the rules, and, you know, you'll make it. Except nobody told us making it just meant ending up on antidepressants with at least SUV and a mild to wild drinking problem. But now that the old myth's gone flat, something unexpected is happening. People are starting to look for stories that feel true again. They don't have to be happy or shiny. They just have to be honest. Nietzsche once said that when you stare into the abyss also stares into you. But what he didn't mention is that sometimes, if you stare long enough, the abyss cracks a smile. Because once the old lies burn away, what's left is terrifyingly simple. You can either cling to the ashes or build something new out of them. That's the new myth. It's not rising from the ashes, but accepting that ashes are the natural state of all things, and then building anyway. It's a story without heroes or villains, just human beings doing their best to stay kind while the world gets weird. It's a rejection of all those tired fantasies of progress, endless growth, salvation, and an embrace of something older and smaller and, well, more true. Like community gardens, campfire storytelling, or I don't know, maybe the deep satisfaction of fixing your own damn sink. And it's also a refusal to romanticize the collapse, as tempting as it may be. Because, I mean, let's be real. It isn't fun. It's difficult, dirty, inconvenient as hell, and usually smells like wet drywall. But it is real. And realness has been in short supply for a long, long time. Albert Camus wrote about the invincible summer inside of us. That small, stubborn warmth that refuses to die even in the coldest season. That's what I think the new myth is. It's not a religion or even a revolution. It's just the quiet realization that being alive here now, despite everything, is still something sacred. And you won't see it trending. You won't find it in a TED Talk or on some self-improvement podcast. It doesn't need a brand or a slogan. It's the story that you tell yourself when you lost all the others. That meaning isn't given, it's made. That collapse isn't the end, it's the reset. And that maybe we needed the world to fall apart so we could finally remember what it means to be human again. Because underneath all the noise, the corrupt politics, the ideologies, the marketing, we've always been telling the same story. People break, things fall apart. And somehow, against all the odds, we keep showing up anyway. I think that's a myth worth keeping. Instead of the one about endless progress or perfect futures. But the one about the strange and beautiful resilience of a species just too stubborn to quit. So welcome to the aftermath. The world, it didn't really end. It just shed its costume. And now it's up to us to decide what story that we want to live next. And maybe this time, we pick one that doesn't require us to destroy ourselves to believe it. Okay, that's all I have today. Thanks so much for watching.